Track 4, Cognitive Dissonance and Codependence. On the last track, we examine the various sides of the controversy regarding repression. On this track, we will discuss cognitive dissonance created in the therapist when predisposed ideas are challenged. We will also discuss 8 key characteristics that red flag your codependent clients to be predisposed to therapist implementation of ideas of sexual abuse. When a person's core beliefs have been challenged, as you know, a great internal conflict results in the mind of the client, known as cognitive dissonance. How does cognitive dissonance relate to repressed memories of sexual abuse? When 2 different opinions are presented, the client must choose one. In the case of repressed memories, authority figures such as the child's parents or therapist play a major role, as you know. As Festinger states, if one opinion advocates seems as an expert or very knowledgeable about such matters, the dissonance between knowledge of his contrary opinion and one's own opinion will be greater. I'm sure you probably have observed this in your therapy sessions with your clients. Festinger adds, the person will actively avoid situations and information which would likely increase the dissonance. In therapy, this may result in the client's cutting himself or herself off from friends and family that express any doubts. By maintaining a very close-minded approach, the clients isolate themselves in a reality that might be false and unhealthy for their growth. Let's switch the focus for a minute, away from pseudo-memories or predisposition of our clients to therapist predisposition. How susceptible are therapists to pseudo-memories? For example, how quick are therapists to assign diseases for which there is little evidence? Let's look at an experiment that a Stanford psychologist and law professor, D.L. Rosenhan, had conducted. Rosenhan sent 8 subjects to be admitted to 12 inpatient psychiatric wards around the United States, where during admission they complained of hearing voices that said words such as empty, hollow, or a thud sound. In reality, the subjects were students and other ordinary health volunteers from the community. As soon as they were admitted, they totally ceased simulating any symptoms of schizophrenia whatsoever. However, Rosenhan noted the pseudo-patient spoke to patients and staff as he might ordinarily speak. However, because there is commonly little to do on a psychiatric ward, he attempted to engage others in conversation. When asked by staff how he was feeling, he indicated he was fine. At the end of the experiment, none of the healthy people were detected by psychiatrists. Eventually, each was released with a diagnosis of schizophrenia in remission. Some were kept in the hospital anywhere from a week to almost 2 months. The student and volunteer subjects wrote down their observations of the therapist and patients. Amazingly, in each case, it was only the other patients in the hospital that detected the pseudo-patients and not the staff. The other patients would make statements like, "You're not crazy. You're a journalist or a professor. You're checking up on this hospital, aren't you?" The real patients, just by normal, everyday observation, could see, without any pre-accepted theory, that the subjects were perfectly healthy. However, other psychiatrists, even though they kept close observation of the subject's behavior, could not see that they were devoid of mental defects. Now, regarding sexually abused clients, once the therapist is predisposed to the idea of sexual abuse, perhaps by a wife seeking a custody suit, the therapist may tend to pursue the line of thought regarding sexual abuse. Do you agree? Just as the therapist on the inpatient unit were predisposed to see the healthy subject as being schizophrenic because of their admission criteria. Take a few minutes, and you might want to turn the CD player off. In short, take a long, ethical minute of contemplation and consider what factors cause you to be predisposed or have a tendency to develop certain attitudes, feelings, and perhaps diagnoses under the right circumstances. Can you recall a patient's or client's name where you received information from other family, school records, parents that predisposed you to be looking for sexual abuse? Could you have asked leading probing questions in that interview that possibly could have implanted false memories in your client? What was your diagnosis, and what were the factors that contributed to that diagnosis? Let's go back now to the point of cognitive dissonance. As you know, many clients are people pleasers. Could you have created in your client a conflict between what you are expecting them to say in the session and what really happened? Ask yourself if your clients were unconsciously getting on the bandwagon. Have they mentioned, for example, watching Oprah, Jerry Springer, or Dr. Phil? Sophia, age 47, suggested to her therapist for 3 months that she believed she might have been abused as a young child and had repressed the memories. When asked how she had come to this realization, she stated, "Well, I saw this episode on Oprah where all these women had repressed the memory of their childhood abuse. They described the symptoms they had had before their discovery. Oh my God, it was exactly what I was going through." Her therapist was skeptical because the symptoms Sophia described were not the ones she had been exhibiting the month before. Before treating Sophia, the therapist had compiled an 8-point checklist of examples of clients that are overeager to find a cure for their behaviors and therefore jump at any influence, for example, alleged child abuse. As I read this 8-point checklist, you may find many of your clients have exhibited these behaviors. However, if the overall context is, for example, a custody suit or jail time for the abuser, you might use this checklist as merely food for thought. A client who may be predisposed to therapist implementation of false memories might exhibit the following codependent type characteristics. Here's the checklist. Number 1, try to please others instead of themselves. Number 2, abandon their routine to respond to do something for somebody else. 3, believe deep inside other people are somehow responsible for them. 4, feel angry, victimized, unaccepted, or used. 5, finding themselves saying yes when they mean no. 6, believe other people are making them feel crazy. 7, believe they don't deserve to have good things happen to them. And 8, wish other people, including their therapist, would like and love them. Such descriptions fit Sophia, and her therapist soon realized that any kind of diagnostic implication from her would unduly influence Sophia into trying to fit her symptoms into the disorder. As a result, the therapist focused the sessions on Sophia with little input from herself. After several sessions of gently refusing to answer leading questions, Sophia began to open up more about her life. The ethical gray line is not very clear here, of course. Ask yourself, at what point are you leading the client into false memories of sexual abuse? On the other hand, at what point are you ignoring or invalidating their needs? On this track, we discussed predisposing the therapist to a certain diagnosis, as well as the impact the therapist can have on their client's allegations of sexual abuse. On the next track, we will examine the influence of New Age mentality on repressed memories of possible sexual abuse as it relates to intuition, imagination, and hearsay. Question 4. Does your client who states he or she has been sexually abused exhibits a predisposition towards perhaps codependence?